This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Wendy Gillette in Paris. A threat to Russian President Vladimir Putin's leadership has quickly come to an end. The leader of a mercenary group turned back his fighters from Moscow and agreed to leave for Belarus. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg says Putin reversed his earlier hardline position.
Putin yesterday came out quite strongly on television, talking about betrayal and treachery and Russia being stabbed in the back. And yet by the evening, all charges were dropped against Yevgeny Prigozhin. Yes, Mr. Prigozhin had to go to Belarus, but he's a free man.
It's been 1 year since the Supreme Court reversed the abortion ruling Roe v. Wade. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke about the impact of the Dobbs ruling in Charlotte.
1 in 3 women of reproductive age live in a state with a ban, some with no exceptions. Even for survivors of the crimes of rape and incest.
Cities across the world are celebrating Pride Month. Paris held its event yesterday. New York, San Francisco, and Chicago are next. CBS News correspondent Jennifer Kuiper reports.
Chicago is a welcoming and accepting city.
And to ensure today's festive Pride parade goes off without a hitch, Chicago Interim Police Superintendent Fred Waller says it's all hands on deck.
We're going to have additional officers deployed to staff the parade.
Waller has spent time meeting with business owners and community members to talk about public safety and says when the parade winds down,
we're going to have our most experienced officers working throughout the night.
Today is World Upcycling Day, which celebrates the repurposing of old products into something new. CBS's Danya Backus has more on one business.
At Shuggy's Trash Pie in San Francisco, one person's trash is another person's ingredient. Co-owner Kayla Abe says they use upcycled toppings on their pizzas, like ugly mushrooms, discolored tomatoes, or cutoffs of meats.
Some people might not read that it's a beef heart meatball, and they just might see meatball. They order it, and they're like, that was the best meatball I've ever had in my life.
Over 35 million tons of food are wasted every year in the U.S.
There's controversy over a team's name. This time it's in the summer college baseball world. Correspondent Allison Keyes explains.
In Georgia, there's a summer college baseball team called Macon Bacon. But a doctor's group that promotes animal rights and plant-based eating is crying foul and wants the team to change its name. The group even sponsored a billboard begging fans to keep bacon off your plate. The team's name was chosen in a vote by fans.
The group wants the name changed to Macon Fakin' Bacon. The team says the Macon Bacon will keep sizzling forever. This is CBS News.
Hiring is a lot easier with Indeed. Their powerful platform makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson and Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Smoke from Canadian wildfires and exhaust from cars and trucks led to several air quality alerts in Wisconsin this week. Over in Utah, they do something every year called the Clean Air Challenge, where they encourage people to use other kinds of transportation. Alex Gonzalez reports.
This might mean carpooling, using public transportation, walking or biking, as well as consolidating trips or working from home when you can. Kim Frost with the Utah Clean Air Partnership says nearly half of the pollutants that contribute to poor air quality can be attributed to emissions from cars and trucks. Frost says the alternatives can not only help improve air quality, but could also save you time, money, and gas.
This is really a way to bring attention to that and help Utahns understand how they can be part of that solution and reduce our emissions by just making small, simple changes.
Since the first year of the Clear the Air Challenge in 2009, Utahns have made 1.3 million fewer trips, saved more than 20 million miles, and reduced their emissions by more than 6,700 tons. Frost says in years past, the challenge would take place in February, which is when Utah typically experiences the winter inversion period, when air quality visibly deteriorates. This year, the event will take place in July to address the state's summertime ozone issues.
We have some ozone issues in Utah, particularly along the Wasatch Front, that are causing us more and more concern. And so we wanted to get people involved in the challenge in July so that they not only were making changes during the summer when we need it, but also it's an education opportunity for us.
Governor Spencer Cox has invested what she calls huge amounts into active transportation trails, specifically designed for people on conventional personal and electrical bikes, as well as pedestrians, all in an effort to reduce commuter traffic. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The law firm of Gingras Thompson & Walks has a track record of making life-changing, positive differences for their clients. $5.25 million to a woman who suffered brain injuries and her husband passed away when struck by a drunk driver. $1 million to three different individuals injured by drunk drivers. $1 million settlement to a man injured in a motorcycle accident. Call Gingras Thompson & Walks, 855-954-1186.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, June 24th, 2023. My name is Jim Santel, and this is our weekly review, our analysis and our discussion of those most important news stories and events in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me again this beautiful Saturday morning. We're coming to you from the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha, but broadcasting throughout the listening regions of Civic Media throughout this wonderful state of Wisconsin. We're also taking your calls this morning, both this hour and in our second hour. That phone number is 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789, always in partnership with my professional, engaging and wonderful producer Anya, who's with me in the studios this morning. Looking forward to hearing your calls, your questions, your comments, your observations about the topics of our days. And as always, this morning, coming live to you from Waukesha, going out throughout the state of Wisconsin, we have an ambitious, always ambitious, but achievable syllabus and agenda for you this morning, hopefully educational and also even inspiring. Always asking those three important questions. What happened? What do we know? What are the facts of the events, the circumstances that animate our lives? Why are those things important? Why are they significant to us? Why are they relevant and material? And what, if anything, can we do, should we do as Americans responsible for the future of our nation and our world? What are the appropriate responses, reactions, and actions in response to the news? Why it is important and our actions in response to all of that? Today, spending principal focus on the United States Supreme Court, as we have done in previous broadcasts. This is the time of year, every year, June of every single year, when our United States Supreme Court, the highest court in our land, issues major decisions of significant importance to all of us. No exception with respect to those decisions already rendered, already given to us by the nine justices up to this point in our history of this year. Also anticipating that next week, Tuesday and Thursday, likely to be the most significant decision days in this term of the United States Supreme Court, 2022-2023. We'll talk about some of the cases likely to be issued, decisions, rulings likely to be given out next week on those days, and certainly be spending a lot of time in our next program on the 1st of July talking about those important cases, those to be decided this coming week. But this week, this morning, in this principal hour, and perhaps in the next hour as well, we're going to talk about at least four of the major cases that have been decided by our Supreme Court, even since we have been together live here on the studios, the broadcast studios and broadcast areas of Civic Media. We're going to chat about why those cases are important in their individual facts, but also consistent with our commission to talk about why these things are relevant and important, why those cases, these four in particular, have great meaning beyond just the particular rulings for our future and for the livelihood of all of us here in the United States of America. We're going to be chatting about all of those four. As a way of introducing that, of course, we could not chat today about our United States Supreme Court without observing the fact that today is the one-year anniversary of the rendition, the issuance by our United States Supreme Court of one of the most landmark, significant cases in all of its history. And that, of course, is the case of Dobbs that overturned Roe versus Wade, reversing nearly 50 years of an understanding that inside our Constitution, there is built in, by virtue of something called a penumbra of rights emanating from all sorts of areas inside our Constitution, a fundamental right to privacy, and in particular with respect to Dobbs versus Jackson Reproductive Services, particularly in that case finding that the longstanding 49-year tradition, 49-year precedent in our nation establishing a right to abortion in our states, in all 50 states, no longer adheres in the Constitution, and sending that decision back into the states for its determination, for the determination of legislatures and courts throughout the United States of America. That happened 1 year ago today. A decision, not a unanimous decision by any means, strong dissents on behalf of the minority population of our Supreme Court, but an equally strong statement by our United States Supreme Court, written by Justice Samuel Alito. We're going to hear more about from him in just a moment or so as well. A decision that told us that Roe versus Wade is not only antiquated, but simply wrong at the time of its decision. And that Justice Blackmun, when he issued that decision way back in 1973, January of 1973, was simply mistaken and was misleading us, was telling us something that wasn't true about our Constitution at the time that he rendered that decision. We know that in the wake of the 1973 decision, in the wake of Roe versus Wade, abortions were proper, were legal, at least in the first trimester, and a case following up on that called Casey, authored by Sandra Day O'Connor, sort of the strict trimester approach articulated by the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade was abandoned in favor of a broader standard that talked about viability of the fetus. But we know that at least in the first weeks of a pregnancy, for 50 years, the states had no right to intervene, greater involvement of the states during approximately the second trimester, and there could in fact be state intrusions, state restrictions on abortion in that final trimester. We also know, of course, that in America in those 50 years, the great majority of abortions took place not in that final trimester, but rather in the first trimester. And that's why this change in the law accomplished a year ago today was so dramatically significant in the history of our lives for all women and all men, I would also offer in the United States of America. Not only did it change the landscape of our understanding of abortion rights in America, and we'll talk more about what has happened in the years since that issuance of the decision, but also opened the door to question whether or not there's a fundamental privacy right inside the Constitution itself. Privacy rights going back to 1965, probably even before then, but articulated by the Supreme Court in a case called Griswold versus Connecticut, finding a clear privacy right emanating from the Constitution, this penumbra notion that I described before, emanating from various rights, the Ninth Amendment, fundamental rights throughout the United States Constitution that establish privacy rights for all of us. And those things include things like the right to make decisions about medical care, end-of-life treatment, what your family looks like, same-sex marriage, interracial marriage, all kinds of things out there. A list is long. And the concern about the rescission of Roe versus Wade by Dobbs is not only with respect to the dramatic impact that it had upon abortion rights in America, but also this notion that for the first time in our history, it turned back the movement forward, providing more privacy rights for all of us in America. And of course, we've got at least one justice, Justice Thomas, who has said that that effort to turn back privacy rights in America should continue. And so it opens up the door, great significance for that decision issued a year ago today. What has happened since the past year? Well, we know that because of this decision, finding that the Constitution no longer protects under privacy rights theories, the right of women to an abortion, to reproductive services. We know that there are at least 14 states that have, through legislative fiat, other movements, banned abortions entirely. Probably another 12, depending upon how you count their restrictions, their limitations, that are either heading in that direction or somewhere in between. We've got about 26 states, about half the states in our union this day, a year after the rendition of the decision in Dobbs, that have imposed precisely the restrictions that were described if, in fact, Roe was overturned. There are about 20 additional states, to the good, to the credit of them, that have enhanced and supported and even adopted new measures to ensure abortion rights. But we've got a struggle out there, both legislatively and also in the courts right here in the state of Wisconsin. We've got litigation determining whether or not 1849 legislation that banned abortion made it criminal in our state, whether that's still viable, or whether subsequent pieces of legislation overtook that, overturned that, effectively rescinded that, or if indeed the mere passage of time since 1849 means that we should no longer be observing that 1849 statute. That goes on right here in the state of Wisconsin. We know as well, recent polling indicates that about 6 in 10 Americans, 60% of us, support in some way, shape, or form abortion rights, privacy rights, reproductive rights under our Constitution. We know as well that in the past year, we have had some troubling developments in a number of different areas. Rises in violence against those people who legitimately, lawfully, in many states continue to provide abortion services. A 231% increase in stalking. A 100% increase in arson. A 229% increase in burglaries. Even home invasions, property invasions. A 25% of that. Clinics and other places of medical health providing being closed or shut down. Confusion about the shifting laws in various states. 66 clinics have either stopped providing abortion. Among those, about 26 shut down entirely. There's been a rise in telehealth abortion. And, of course, we also know that this issue related to mifepristone, right now pending in front of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, still not resolved about whether or not the authorization given mifepristone, which is this all-important drug that accomplishes abortions medically, safely, according to the FDA, also addresses other healthcare matters in connection with pregnancies and miscarriages in particular, whether that drug will be commonly available throughout the United States of America. That continues to be unresolved, sitting right now in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And even to this day, legislatively, there is more movement in the wake of the rescission, the vacation of Roe versus Wade. Lindsey Graham and other senators announcing that they're going to be pushing for a nationwide ban in all of our states of abortion through the United States Congress. He, of course, the United States Senator. All of that happening in the wake of the determination that privacy rights no longer include the right to abortion in America under our Constitution, under the ruling of the United States Supreme Court. Today, the anniversary of that announcement. When we come back after this first break, we're going to chat about other cases decided recently by our United States Supreme Court in a number of also hugely important areas. Stay with us for that discussion and more this morning on Morning Cannolis.
Achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs today, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Wachs, GTWLawyers.com.
the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Gary from Sussex. Hey, Gary.
Whose birthday is it? Is it both you guys' birthday or is it Mike's?
It's my birthday today. Mike's was 2 days ago.
I'm going to sing a happy birthday, and I'm going to sing it the right way. Happy birthday to you, Mr. President of his radio station and his sidekick.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge, counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for Organized Crime, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Jane Matinere.
Before I send boxes over, I have to take all of my things out. These boxes were interspersed with all sorts of things.
But who doesn't stuff their pants and their shoes into a box full of work documents to sort out later? Every time I leave a job, that's what I end up doing with my box of work papers. Bras go in there and just, you know, and I'll sort it out later.
As Goes Wisconsin, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
This summer, 540 AM WAUK has a new lineup. At 12:15, Wisconsin Roundtable. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show on 540 AM WAUK. WAUK has a new lineup. At 12:15, Wisconsin Roundtable. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show on 540 AM WAUK.
A fiddler on the roof. Sounds crazy, no? But in our little village,
and we are back this morning on Morning Cannolis. We're celebrating this morning also Broadway and Broadway musicals, in particular observing today the recent death of one of the major figures in Broadway history, who authored the lyrics to that important piece of music. 99 years old at the time of his death, a significant death in the history of America. His name in particular, Sheldon Harnick. He was born in Chicago 99 years ago. He died this past week. The author of lyrics in the Broadway musical Fiddler on the Roof, other musicals including She Loves Me. Celebrating today all kinds of Broadway musicals being brought to you through the wonderful music selections of my terrific producer here this morning, Anya. And again, thanking you for joining us this morning on Morning Cannolis. I promised right before the break that we're going to be chatting about the United States Supreme Court this morning, and indeed we're going to do that all this hour and probably some of next as well. And yes, indeed, we are going to talk more about ethics related to the conduct of our Supreme Court justices, brought once again to the attention of America and certainly the attention of at least a couple of United States senators by virtue of the revelations related to the conduct, the past conduct of Associate Justice Samuel Alito in a fishing trip that he took many, many years ago to Alaska. We'll talk about that, the consequences of that, why that's relevant, and why that's meaningful as well. This morning, in our next segments, talking about four major cases that have been issued by our United States Supreme Court in this, its final tranche, if you will, its final period of time during which it's going to be issuing a number of different cases. Let's talk about all of those, not only discussing what those cases mean, but also why they're important beyond just decisions being made. Let's begin with a decision rendered just yesterday, just Friday, that basically said that the Biden administration could, in fact, set priorities for which undocumented immigrants to arrest and which to leave alone, very broadly speaking, basically rejecting a challenge from two very conservative states that had pressed for some more aggressive enforcement and basically handing a huge victory to the Secretary of Homeland Security and President Biden more generally. Where does this come about? How does this case develop? And what is the history behind all of this? We recall well that during the Trump administration, there was this pledge basically to take the shackles as the Trump administration authorities said, off of Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE agents, and basically saying that anyone in the country without legal documentation could be targeted for deportation. That was basically the approach of the Trump administration. Under those guidelines, the agents, again, under the supervision of the Secretary of Homeland Security, had broad breath, if you will, to address not only those who pose the most significant threats to our community, but also people who are here, admittedly illegally, but who are not causing any problem, not committing crimes. And when the Biden administration came in, they basically said, we're not going to pursue that anymore. We're going to recognize a couple of things. We're going to recognize, first, that we have limited resources. We know well that the Congress has not addressed the issue of immigration, both in terms of staffing, but also in terms of policy for many, many years. And one of those issues is that resources have been depressed for a long period of time. And so as a result of that, the question has been, with limited resources, where do you allocate those resources most effectively for purposes of understanding, for promoting our immigration purposes? And the Biden administration said, we're going to reject the guidelines set forth by the Trump administration, and we're going to focus only on those who have the most significant national security threats, who pose the greatest threat to our safety, our security, engaging in crime and those kinds of activities. And so the Biden administration announced these new guidelines, these new principles, well over a year or so ago, basically giving the Secretary of Homeland Security the authority to say that under limited resources situations, we're going to have our agents identify and deport those people at the top of the list who are posing the greatest security risk, and prioritizing those as opposed to going after those people, again, illegally here, but nonetheless not providing a reason for believing they're engaging in crime or their national security threats, are basically a reasonable recognition, a law enforcement recognition, given limited resources, of where you best apply and address the problems of immigration. Well, what happened, as I said, we've got a couple of states, Texas and Louisiana, that said, wait a minute, that is not proper. We are going to allege that that kind of change in the policy is illegal, and they did so. And they brought this lawsuit challenging that in particular. Makes its way ultimately through to a federal district court judge. His name is Drew Tipton. And for about a year, because Drew Tipton found that those new regulations of the Biden administration were in fact illegal, were an exercise of executive authority that could not stand, he basically suspended those rules and regulations, telling the Secretary of Homeland Security that, nope, you cannot do this. You cannot make that kind of legitimate, sensible, resource-based, legally-based, law enforcement-based decision about how to apply the immigration laws. Fairly outrageous thing for a federal district court judge to do. And that stayed in place until just yesterday, when the United States Supreme Court got a hold of this and said, wait a minute, this lawsuit should not be here at all in the first place. Interestingly, written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and again, giving a major victory to the Biden administration when it comes to the enforcement of laws. Brett Kavanaugh is saying in particular that if this court greenlighted this lawsuit, we could anticipate complaints in future years about alleged executive branch under enforcement of any similarly worded laws, whether they be drug laws, gun laws, obstruction of justice laws, or the like. We declined to start the federal judiciary down that uncharted path. And so he basically said, no standing, no basis in these states to challenge this. We're not going to do this. The Biden guidelines stand. When we come back, I'm going to give you more insight into exactly what Brett Kavanaugh was talking about, and then also talk about the dissents coming from some anticipated justices, and explaining once again why this case is important, not only for immigration, but beyond that, for the enforcement of law in America, right here on our broadcast. Stay with us for that.
Preparing me to marry whoever Papa picks. The
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
CBS News Brief. An unprecedented threat to Russian President Vladimir Putin's leadership has quickly fizzled out. The leader of a mercenary group agreed to exile in Belarus. Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan asked Secretary of State Antony Blinken about Putin.
Do you know the whereabouts of Vladimir Putin right now? Is he in Moscow?
I don't want to speculate on that or what information that we have. We're watching that carefully.
This weekend marks a year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke in Charlotte about the states that have restricted abortions.
In the top 10 states in our country with the highest rates of maternal mortality, you see these bans in effect.
Houston celebrated Pride Month with its annual parade.
A chance for us to speak out and literally just fight for our rights that we should already have.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
One call can do it all. Your business's message can be broadcast across the entire state of Wisconsin through the Civic Media Network of stations, or we can focus the campaign in your hometown. We have the flexibility. You have the control. Civic Media, 608-819-8255.
The law firm of Gingras Thompson & Wachs has a track record of making life-changing, positive differences for their clients. $5.25 million to a woman who suffered brain injuries and her husband passed away when struck by a drunk driver. $1 million to three different individuals injured by drunk drivers. $1 million settlement to a man injured in a motorcycle accident. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Wachs, GTWLawyers.com.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge, counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for Organized Crime, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Gary from Sussex. Hey, Gary.
Whose birthday is it? Is it both you guys' birthday or is it Mike's?
It's my birthday today. Mike's was 2 days ago.
I'm going to sing a happy birthday, and I'm going to sing it the right way. Happy birthday to you, Mr. President of his radio station and his sidekick.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge, counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for Organized Crime, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry
and Jane Matinere.
Before I send boxes over, I have to take all of my things out. These boxes were interspersed with all sorts of things.
But who doesn't stuff their pants and their shoes into a box full of work documents to sort out later? Every time I leave a job, that's what I end up doing with my box of work papers. Bras go in there and just, you know, and I'll sort it out later.
As Goes Wisconsin, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Succeed, follow my lead, and yes, indeed.
And we are back this morning on Morning Cannolis. We're talking in this segment and next segments all about our United States Supreme Court in this time of year when indeed they're issuing these major decisions affecting our lives. First one we're chatting about this morning is this case involving immigration, something the legislation, the legislature itself has not addressed. Our Congress has not addressed for a long period of time, but the Supreme Court did just yesterday, handing the Biden administration a major victory when it comes to its authority, its discretion in making making law enforcement decisions about how to enforce immigration laws, a huge victory for the Secretary of Homeland Security in making the decision, the right, the appropriate decision to apply limited resources to address those folks who are here illegally, but who also are engaging in criminal activity, posing a threat to our national and local and statewide safety and security, even national security, focusing on that as opposed to other folks who are here illegally, but who are not posing those same threats. Along the way, significantly, Brett Kavanaugh, writing for the majority, comments once again about the capacity of these states to bring this lawsuit in particular. He says, the states have brought an extraordinarily unusual lawsuit. That's peculiar commentary for a Supreme Court justice to describe a lawsuit in that way. He says, they want a federal court to order the executive branch to alter its arrest policies so as to make more arrests. Federal courts, he said, have not traditionally entertained that kind of lawsuit. Indeed, the states, those bringing this challenge to the Biden administration rules and regulations, the states cite no precedent for a lawsuit like this. He said that if Congress was free to act, if it was dissatisfied with the Biden administration's approach, but he went on to say Congress possesses an array of tools to analyze and influence those policies, and indeed they do. They can do some oversight, they can do appropriations, the legislative process itself, Senate confirmations, all those kinds of things that Congress can do. However, you don't do this through the federal courts, Justice Kavanaugh, and indeed seven other members of the Supreme Court agreed with him. This was an 8-1 decision yesterday. Only Sam Alito in the dissenting position. He said that the majority had given much too much leeway to the executive branch. He said, to put the point simply, Congress enacted a law that requires the apprehension and detention of certain illegal immigrants whose release, it thought, would endanger public safety. The Secretary of DHS, Homeland Security, does not agree with that categorical requirement. He prefers a more flexible policy. Well, that may in fact be true, Mr. Associate Justice, but he again in the minority. Thankfully, yesterday, a major case, not only for immigration enforcement here in the United States of America, but why is it significant beyond just that? Two reasons I'd offer. One is, of course, we all still have a great deal of work to do in this area of immigration. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, established under the Obama administration, that continues to be the focus of both legislative review and certainly judicial review. Curious to determine whether or not the United States courts, the United States officials generally, will regard this case, again involving Joseph Biden and the states, Texas, Louisiana, and others out there, if they regard this language as something to be taken a look at and be guiding their own responses to our DACA challenges accordingly. Immigration laws generally today, again, need to be addressed to bring them current, not only in terms of resources, which the majority identified just yesterday as a major problem in our nation, but beyond that, this lawsuit and the decision in particular makes clear that the federal courts should not be involved in what are called these policy-related decisions, right? When finding that Drew Tipton, this federal district court judge in Texas, had overstepped his bounds, basically saying you have no business playing in this area in the first place. This is not only, as he said, wildly unusual, but no jurisdiction, no standing for these particular states to bring this into court, no basis, no damage, no harm to them. What is this case doing here? Hopefully sending the message to others who would attack these kinds of discretionary decisions, frankly, made by all administrations, regardless of which side of the political aisle they happen to fall. Those are things properly vested in the executive branch. Once the Congress gives the authority to a secretary, including the Secretary of Homeland Security, to act, that's the kind of thing that should be given broad breadth in terms of discretion allocated to that secretary and others in other areas of executive authority. So again, a major case, not only for immigration, but hopefully a lesson taught to all of us out there in all areas about the proper roles of the executive branch and the legislative branch, and yes, indeed, the judicial branch as well. Major case, Texas versus Biden, United States versus Texas, depending upon how you codify and describe the case, coming out just yesterday from our United States Supreme Court, going to define a lot of our future. Let's talk about another one of those cases decided a couple of weeks ago, also defining our future, also to the good. Another reason to celebrate in the midst of some other concerns about what the Supreme Court has done historically, to celebrate a couple of its recent decisions. This case is called Allen versus Milligan. We have talked about this case at length in the past. This has to do with gerrymandering and the access to polls. Voting rights in America, the Voting Rights Act passed in the 1960s as a way of ensuring that people of all races, of all colors, have access to the polls. Originally acted in 1965, Section 2 of that act, which is this basic enforcement principle under the act, tracks the language pretty much of the 15th Amendment. What does the 15th Amendment say? Provides that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. One of those major post-Civil War amendments to our Constitution. 1965 Voting Rights Act, that's what it says. Other sections, Sections 4 and Section 5, which we'll touch upon in just a few moments, also provide enforcements of the 15th Amendment and the Voting Rights Act in particular. What happens? Well, how do we get back to the United States Supreme Court in this case called Allen versus Milligan, decided on June 8th of this year, June 8th, just a couple of weeks ago? Well, way back in 2021, the Alabama legislature, and yes, that's where this case comes from, Alabama, just like here in Wisconsin, drew some legislative lines, new congressional maps that undisputably gave black voters in Alabama far less representation in the House of Representatives than their population numbers would generally indicate. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, it's very clear. Nobody disputes this, that African Americans in the state of Alabama compose about 28% of the state's total citizenry. This total population, about 28%. The state of Alabama has 7 congressional districts allocated to it by virtue of the census and by virtue of those allocations generally made throughout the United States of America. And so, very generally, as we have discussed here in Wisconsin, what are the appropriate allocations to be made? What kinds of things should we be concerned about when it comes to racial gerrymandering? Well, very generally, that 28% would mean that roughly 2 of those 7 districts would be districts that would be principally black majority in nature, where the prospects of their being elected a black representative to the United States Congress would be enhanced, increased, not necessarily guaranteed, but there would be black majorities who could vote in favor of those candidates that they feel most strongly appropriately represent their interests in Congress. So the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, a 3-judge panel a number of years ago, gets a hold of this. And basically the Alabama legislature, once again, does not in fact draw those lines, gives 1 of the 7 districts to black majority populations. The United States Court of Appeals says, no, you did that improperly. And the Voting Rights Act requires you to do a better job, says to the Alabama legislature, go back and do this again. You've done it improperly. Go back and redraw some lines here in such a way that probably 2 of the 7, not just 1 of the 7 districts, do in fact represent blacks more equitably. And it turns out that under a case called Thornburg versus Jingles, many, many years ago, Thornburg versus Jingles, in that case, the Supreme Court established the standards under which federal courts address these kinds of things. And there are many standards, basically analyzing the demographics, the nuts and bolts, we would kind of say the science of voting, getting involved in the weeds, what's going on in Alabama, what's going on in Wisconsin, other states, doing an analysis based upon who lives where, what the population is like, how it votes, the historical basis of discrimination, those kinds of things. Thornburg versus Jingles establishes these standards, including 2 in particular, whether you could draw a second in Alabama, a second majority black district. And in fact, turns out you can, without doing great discomfort to line drawing. Turns out that much of the, not all, but much of the black population in Alabama is in and around Atlanta and other places as well. And you could, in fact, draw two districts without being gerrymandered or salamandered, as that word originally comes from, in such a way that you would look and say, gosh, that district looks very odd to me just geographically. You can do that. You can draw a second majority black district because African Americans live in those areas sufficiently close in proximity to do that. And second, you need to show that Alabamans generally vote as a block for candidates who are generally opposed by voters of color. And again, that's perhaps a difficult thing to say out loud, but that's part of the standard under Thornburg versus Jingles, one of the many standards that are brought to this analysis of whether or not there's been gerrymandering. And so the Fifth Circuit looks at Thornburg versus Jingles and says, yes, Alabama, you have violated the Voting Rights Act under Thornburg. Go back and do it again. The Alabama legislature, not happy with that, says, number one, no, we did not, in fact, do any gerrymandering at all. What we did is we drew lines appropriately, no violation of the Voting Rights Act. The one district that we provided, which was majority black, that comports with the law. And second, and this is why this case is so very important, the legislature also came back and said, abandon Thornburg versus Jingles. Abandon that kind of testing analysis that determines whether or not gerrymandering is in violation of our Constitution, of our fundamental rights to ensure that all Americans have access to the polling places. And effectively asking the Supreme Court to withdraw that standard and apply a second standard, a new standard that would establish that all you need to do is come forward with one legitimate non-racial basis for going ahead with changing lines in a congressional district. Even if the impact is to have a discriminatory effect on voters, all you need to do is come forward and come up with one justification. That would be enough. And an awful lot of people, including me, as we've talked on this broadcast in the past, looked at this case, again, Allen versus Milligan, and thought, gosh, the Supreme Court may well be on the verge of dealing another blow to the Voting Rights Act. And we waited with bated breath to determine what the Supreme Court would do. In fact, it did not do that. It did not send another blow into the Voting Rights Act. In fact, earlier this month, by a 5-4 vote, the court effectively reaffirmed the standard in Thornburg versus Jingles and concluded that Alabama had in fact diluted the power of black voters by drawing a congressional voting map with this single district in which the voters of color comprise a majority. So basically saying that the legislature, you're completely wrong. You got to go back and draw lines better than you have. You got to establish that second majority black district. A major case under the Voting Rights Act, again, reaffirming this standard under the 1965 law. Along the way, Chief Justice John Roberts, joined by Associate Justices Brett Kavanaugh, once again, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. That's the five. They say this: we have applied the Voting Rights Act in an unbroken line of decisions stretching four decades now. For 40 years, we've done this. The court, that is, the court as of this month, sees no reason to disturb what it described as the lower court's careful analysis that Alabama's extensive history of repugnant racial and voting-related discrimination is undeniable and well-documented. Basically describe this repugnant racial and voting-related discrimination in the state of Alabama and sending that packing. That is strong language for a United States Supreme Court to tell an Alabama or any legislature what it has been doing. Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Alito and Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch in dissent, say basically that the majority forces Alabama to intentionally redraw its longstanding congressional districts so that black voters can control a number of seats roughly proportional to the black share of the state's population. That's correct. That's right. That's exactly what they do. They go on to say Section 2 demands no such thing, and the Constitution would not permit it. They're in the minority. They're the four in the minority. Their view does not stand. It is not the basis for the decision in this case. Again, coming out of Alabama, coming out of a United States Supreme Court. Right after the break, we're going to talk about why this case, again, hugely important for voting rights in America and beyond. Stay with us for that important discussion.
You'll be popular, just not quite as popular as me.
When it comes to a
achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Walks, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Walks today, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Walks, GTWLawyers.com.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge, counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for organized crime, racketeer influenced and corrupt organizations act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Gary from Sussex. Hey, Gary.
Whose birthday is it? Is it both you guys' birthday or is it Dom's or Mike's?
It's my birthday today. Mike's was 2 days ago.
I'm going to sing a happy birthday, and I'm going to sing it the right way. Happy birthday to you, Mr. President of his radio station and his sidekick.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge, counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for organized crime, racketeer influenced and corrupt organizations act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
Back here in this final segment of our first hour this morning on Morning Cannolis. We're talking all about the United States Supreme Court. A couple of cases already under our belt related to voting rights here, discussing this case coming out of Alabama. The reason why it's very significant, the Supreme Court, in a break from its recent history, would support the Voting Rights Act, a reason to celebrate in America that the Voting Rights Act, at least with respect to Section 2, remains strong in the standards under which we assess gerrymandering attempts by legislatures and others around the country. That remains strong, according to not only the so-called liberals on the court, but also the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and yes, indeed, Brett Kavanaugh once again joins with the majority in finding that the Voting Rights Act The Voting Rights Act does, in fact, have meaning today. Why is that significant? Well, again, in recent years, the United States Supreme Court has dealt some significant blows to the Voting Rights Act. A case called Shelby County versus Holder, finding that a combination of what are called Sections 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act, those sections together provided, again, ever since 1965, that in those districts that had historical records of engaging in discriminatory conduct, before they changed their laws with related to voting, they had to get permission. They had to get permission by the United States Department of Justice, the voting rights section, before that happened. It was part of the legislation. Basically, the United States Supreme Court, in a case written by Chief Justice John Roberts way back in a number of years ago, said that those kinds of standards are no longer applicable, that America, if you will, almost lives in a post-racial nation, certainly stunning to say that. But beyond that, that Sections 4 and 5 no longer have the restrictions that they have had in the past. And that's what opened up all of these opportunities for legislatures, including Alabama, other places around the country, to impose new restrictions not seen in decades upon people of color seeking to vote in America. Shelby County versus Holder, that case. And then more recently, a case a couple of years ago, Brnovich versus DNC, coming out of Arizona, another case finding that Section 2, when it comes to allegations of fraud and basically the limitations of voting aspects, that trying to limit voting opportunities, committees, that those things can, in fact, be upheld. Again, a couple of particular statutes passed by the Arizona legislature, upheld by the Supreme Court and viewed as limitations on the capacity of the Department of Justice and others to enforce the Voting Rights Act. That's the history of our recent Supreme Court. And that's why this decision just this month supporting the voting rights for the first time in many years is so very significant. There is yet another voting case that's still pending in front of the United States Supreme Court versus called Moore versus Harper. It has to do with this crazy thing called the independent state legislature theory. We'll talk about it down the road. It's still pending there. It may well be coming out of North Carolina. The Supreme Court will not have to decide that case for a number of procedural reasons, but it's still out there. So we've got at least one more case the Supreme Court is going to be addressing when it comes to voting rights in this term. But we know now that at least with respect to five of our justices, a strong affirmation and an affirmation the law means something, that the Voting Rights Act does apply as we have understood it generally to apply, and that is a more restrictive standard when it comes to assessing gerrymandering does not indeed apply. Case, again, very important in the history of our nation just this month. Let's talk about yet a third case this morning, also coming out of our Supreme Court just about 10 days or so ago. Supreme Court has upheld a 1978 law, aimed at keeping Native American adoptees and other children who are subject to children's court, sometimes family court, with their tribes and with their traditions. It hands a victory, undeniably a victory, to tribes that had argued that a blow to the law would upend the basic principles that allowed them to govern themselves for many, many years. This case, again, pitted a white foster couple from Texas against five Native American tribes and the Interior Department, and they were all battling over the adoption of a Native American child. Now, under something called the Indian Child Welfare Act, called ICWA, sometimes referred to as ICWA, the ICWA, the law required that when it comes to issues related to adoptions and placements and those kinds of things that children's court in particular addresses on a regular basis, those kinds of things that are before our state courts and indeed state courts right here in Wisconsin, that the Indian Child Welfare Act affecting these custody, foster care, adoption matters, and it's a complex law, and basically provides that if a state court determines that a child, before it is either a member of an Indian tribe or is eligible for that membership in a tribe, is a biological child of a member, and for that reason should be placed with an American Indian family if possible. So the law is quite clear on its import. There are some good cause exceptions to it. Plainly does not erase the discretion of particular judges to make determinations based upon the facts, but there is this very strong presumption. And it is based upon, as we all know, hundreds of years of history in which we have variously decided and determined to try to erase Native American heritage from among young people and middle-aged people and even old people of Native American heritage and history. Our history in this area has not been a happy one, has not been a good one. Not only the Trail of Tears, which we all know well, but also changing legislative enactments that variously contemplated assimilation of our Native American indigenous populations, and then turned back and said, no, let's embrace Native American history. And that has gone back and forth for many, many years. Again, in 1978, the Congress basically says, no, we should indeed be ensuring that Native American children in particular have a connection to their heritage and have some way of determining as they grow old and as they grow up what their heritage is all about. And so this action brought by this couple seeking to adopt a Native American child challenged the constitutionality of ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, challenging it, saying, no, indeed, it accomplishes an equal protection violation. It may also accomplish some racial discrimination packed into that equal protection argument. Supreme Court addresses all of this, and indeed, by a vote of 7-2, the justices uphold the legitimacy, the legality, the constitutionality of ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act. Amy Coney Barrett, writing for the majority, affirms the power of the Congress to make laws about Native American tribes, and in particular, child welfare. The ruling is significantly did not resolve this question of whether the law, the Indian Child Welfare Act, discriminates against non-Native families based upon race. That so-called equal protection argument is still out there. But again, a major victory for not only the tribes, but for all Americans when it comes to ensuring that heritage is important and heritage is regarded as an important aspect of dispositions in our courts. When we come back and start our second hour, I'm going to talk more about this ICWA challenge, the decision issued just early this month by the Supreme Court, and yet more Supreme Court decisions this term right here on Morning Cannolis. Stay with us for that discussion.
Look up cheese curds, you'll find this basic definition: wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, so did you guess it takes 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of curds? Now we want to know your favorite and where do you get your squeaky or deep fried curds? Go to our Civic Media Facebook page to share your answers. I'm Terry Barr for the...